Ours will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we're going to have part two of our interview with John Little. Last week, we had John on the show. John is an author, and he's a former writer for Flex Magazine, and he's a big fan and a friend of Mike Mentzer. The late Mike Mentzer passed away 19 years ago this month in June. So we had John on the show to talk about Mike, and we had a long conversation. So we're going to have part two of our interview today. And John today is going to talk about Mike's decision to walk away from bodybuilding after the 1980 Mr. Olympia. And we're also going to talk a little bit about Bruce Lee, because John is a big expert on Bruce Lee. He's written probably at least half a dozen books or more about Bruce Lee. If you search on Amazon, you can see all the books that John has written about Bruce. He's also done a few videos, and one of them was called Bruce Lee, A Warrior Story. And John actually gave me a copy of that that I could use for the YouTube version of this interview. So I put some clips of it on there. So we got a really interesting interview coming up with John Little. Last week's interview was really popular. I'm going to read the emails we got from last week's interview in a second. Before we do that, though, I do want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn body fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can go to their website, flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com, and they will work with anybody in the continental United States. You don't have to live here in Florida. Just tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation. Plus, they will give you 20% off your first order. All right. So, yeah, like I said, we got a lot of emails. I'm going to read those in a second. My fitness challenge on johnhansenfitness.com, my other website, is really going good. We're out now in our second week of all our people that have entered it, and a lot of people are staying in touch with me. They're sending me their measurements. They're sending me their workouts. So that's a good sign. That means they're into it, and I'm going to do my best to make everybody stick with it for the whole 12 weeks, which is the whole summer. This will end on Labor Day, which will be September 7th, which will be here before you know it, right, the way time flies. But I'm going to try and really make sure everybody really changes their bodies this summer by sticking to the diet. I started my diet actually last Monday and been doing good. My big vice is cookies. Chocolate chip cookies are my enemy. So I did really good. I did have some cookies, I got to admit, yesterday, Saturday. But my waist did not go up. And actually, I lost a quarter of an inch off my waist. So that's what I try to do every week. I try to lose at least a quarter of an inch off my waist, which means every month I'll lose a full inch. And after 3 months, I'll lose 3 inches, which is a huge difference. If you've ever dieted, an inch doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a really big difference. So I'm going to try and work through this with these guys, and time for me to get lean too. So I'm going to try and get lean this summer. So I am feeling their pain of staying away from the cookies, because that's my hardest thing. All right, let's get to some of these emails, because last week's show with John Little, I guess Mike Mentzer is still an extremely popular person in the bodybuilding world, even though he's been dead for 20 years, because it got a lot of comments on my Facebook page. All right, so let's see. Nicholas Daver said this was one of the most interesting bodybuilders. I've enjoyed his writings immensely as they got me to think about training, recovery, and intensity in a new way. Walter Vandenbroeden, who was the IFBB judge we just interviewed last week, he said, I think Mike should have changed his way of training a little bit. Too much heavy duty. We invited him to Holland for guest posings and seminars. He agreed to join me to the University of Nijmegen. I'm not saying that right. To do a medical testing on his muscle power. He came in third on the list. First were powerlifting guys, followed by weightlifters. So Mike was strong. Yeah, I think Walter mentioned that a little bit in the interview we did with them a few weeks ago. Rick Wayne, who I've been trying desperately to get on the show, he said he's going to do it, folks, so keep your fingers crossed. I'm going to keep pushing him. But Rick made a comment, and I think we were talking about the 1980 Olympia, and he said, oh, I might just as well have been there, John, by all that I got from Arnold and Frank. The contest finished Mike off. Afterward, I'd get early morning calls from him about the devil, meaning Arnold. The reactions to the result were also hard on Arnold psychologically. His final words to me on the event, 5 years from now, all they'll remember is Arnold won the Olympia 7 times. Obviously, he was wrong about that. He worried also that the main guys wouldn't show up at a show in Columbus, Ohio. On that, too, he was wrong. A lot of things happened behind the scenes in Sydney, never reported. Well, to date, anyway. All right, so if Rick ever does come on the show, I will try to get that out of him. And then I said, wow, Rick, more to the story 40 years later. And he said, you're welcome. In some ways, a similar thing happened in Germany between Arnold and Sergio. Similar, but not quite the same. And Pete Howie said, Rick, I think the Mr. Olympia has always had drama at times. In my opinion, Harold Poole should have won the Olympia in 1966, hands down. I think Sergio should have won more than 3. Robbie at least one of the 3 that Frank won. Danny Padilla in 1981. Basically, I stopped really following it after 80 and 81. And Rick replied, Pete, it's the unpredictability factor that's always made the Olympia special. And Maz said, Rick, unpredictability can be good. Corruption and skullduggery isn't. And Rick says, corruption and skullduggery are everywhere. Remember, however, that the eye of the physique beholding judge is everything. Scott McNally, my friend over at Bodybuilding Nerds Radio, said, such a great interview. I'm inspired, and I'm watching all the Mentzer videos I can find now. His training makes more sense to me now than ever. Joe Amaro said, such a fantastic podcast, Mr. John. You have the best interviews of the sport, and congratulations on your interview on the John Torelli Show. It was great to know a little bit more about your career. All the best. Your podcasts are the new magazines. I can't wait for the next one. David Evans said, I really enjoyed this. I was always a big fan of Mike, and I've read John's books about him. Really interesting to hear stories about him from someone who knew him so well. Peter McGuff, who we just had on the show also a couple weeks ago, said, John, you should request a Rick Wayne interview, but I'm guessing you already have. And I sure have. And John Little posted a picture of Mike Mentzer that looks amazing from the 1980 Olympia. It's a back shot. And John said, what a great lineup it was in 1980. So many competitors look to be in great shape. And then I also posted the interview on my YouTube page. So I got some comments on that as well. Peter McGuff said, John Little was a personal friend of Mike, and he got closer to him than any other writer. Howard Christian said, great interview, John. I can't wait for part 2. Jose Policio said, I've been waiting for you to do something in-depth on Mentzer. Thank you. I'm looking forward to part 2. I'm hoping to hear how John got into writing about Bruce Lee. Look forward to your podcast each week. I listen to them while I'm training. Very inspiring. Keep it up. James Lucas said, Mike Mentzer was one of my all-time favorites. I would love to get one of his heavy-duty tank tops like I had in the old days. Nicholas Daver said, what a wonderful job you do at documenting bodybuilding history. Personally, I think Mike Mentzer and his legacy is one of the most interesting parts of the development of bodybuilding. If you read the magazines from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, mostly it's the same with some exceptions. Mike Mentzer gave high-intensity strength training some credibility, and I think his style of training is soundly based in theory and in practice. John Little has done a marvelous job of continuing Mike Mentzer's work, and I'm really grateful that you took the time to interview John Little. Dave Mastorakis, who was a personal friend of Mike, said, great job, John. And as I mentioned, I did post this on my YouTube page. I got a lot of comments here, so I'll try and read a couple of them here. Odessa File said, I was very selective in choosing my parents, was one of Mentzer's favorite sayings. Chris Dickerson had enormous calves and relatively smallish biceps, which was genetic. Like John Little, my chest grows much easier than my arms and delts. Edgar said, I owe Mike so much. I've learned so much from him, and he influenced my training. Odessa said, the Mentzer brothers were friendly with Samir Banute, and they respected each other. They also got on well with Danny Padilla. Rick Drayson advised that Arnold did not train hours a day, as he claimed, but many of his workouts were much shorter in duration and total sets. Guy Graham said, 18 minutes in, John, and it's a fantastic interview, and John Little's comments on the 80 Olympia are so interesting. Great interview, John. Angel Oliva said, excellent interview. Thank you again, Mr. Hansen and John Little. Howie said, I have not seen John in a long time. Great to hear his insight again. The Spritz said, I'm dying for part two. All right, it's here today. Maz said, amazing conversation. Thank you, John. Brian Nasser said, John Little personifies class. Let's see. Strength Old School said, fantastic video. John Little definitely should start his own YouTube channel. Future video suggestion for you, John. A whole series of videos dedicated to Sergio Oliva interviewing people who have met Sergio and saw him train. Well, I did do one probably about a year and a half ago with some of my friends from Chicago, Al and Terry. So look for that. It's under the Old School Training under my website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com. So if you go under there and look under podcast, look under Old School Bodybuilding, that section, and it's the very first interview under there. And they did, those guys grew up with Sergio in the 60s and 70s, and they saw him since he moved to Chicago. So they saw him when he was Mr. Olympia and when he was really in his prime. So that's a great interview. So check that out. Terry Strand and Al were the guys I interviewed. I got another comment here that said, I'm pretty sure I met John Little at a Muscle Mag store on Dundonald Avenue in Toronto in the late 70s, early to mid 80s. John, if you're reading this, can you please confirm if you worked there, and if so, when? Also, I bought John's book, which he co-authored with Pete Sisko, and I made some very significant gains in size and strength with both power factor and static contraction training. I also met the late Bob Kennedy at the Canadian Championships a couple times and possibly at the Muscle Mag store. Guy Graham said, John, can you get Dave Draper on? I've tried, Guy, many times, but Dave's wife, Larie, said Dave does not want to do any more interviews. He's just not very comfortable doing interviews, I guess. Luis Gomez says, John, I love your videos. You deserve 1 million subscribers. Fitness for You said, bodybuilders and other athletes are bio individuals. And then he said, I'm sorry, but Lee Haney had the right idea. All the heavy-duty guys were injured. Remember that all top bodybuilders have superior genetics, including Mike Mentzer. Lee Haney was right. I like Dorian Yates these days, but he looked like the best powerlifter ever until he got injured. Mark said, Arnold got lucky, but he deserved the win. The rest of the guys had big flaws, and when they stood next to Arnold, he was able to highlight them. Dickerson's arms were too small. Frank was undersized, and the rest of the guys had issues with shape and flow. Myron said, Arnold trained high volume and looked like shit at the 1980 Olympia. Mentzer trained low volume and looked awesome. Pretty sure I would take Mentzer's training advice over Arnold's any day. Even a juiced up Dorian never trained more than 4 days a week at 45 minutes a session. George said, Roger Walker was amazing. Remember, John, Arnold's flatmate from a decade or more ago was the president of the Australian IFBB, Paul Graham, during the 1980 Australian Olympia. Leader asked him to do this. It was a fixed match. That's why Mike Mentzer didn't gain more points. That's why Arnold won. Dave said, it's 100% true, though high-intensity workouts are best, or pace yourself with 20 sets per body part, not so high-intensity, may work for a genetic freak, but not for most of us. Respect to you, John Little. Your 80s books were good. Odessa File said, I agree with John Little, Boyer Coe, Frank Zane, Mike Mentzer, etc. Arnold not only did not deserve to win, he should have been fifth or lower. I think Coe, Mentzer, or Zane all would have been worthy winners. Personally, I feel Chris Dickerson placed higher than he should. I actually met Dickerson twice, and I like him, so I'm not a hater. I just think the aforementioned guys had better physiques. Samuel said collective opinion at the time was that Chris Dickerson won, and Igor said Mentzer never trained the way he said he did. He built his body using a six-day split, Bill Pearl said Mike and his brother Ray used to write him and ask him for help about training. And Franco Colombo said he used to go into the gym at 7 a.m. And when he left at 9 a.m., Mike Mentzer was still hammering away at the weights. John Little is a spoofer and a complete bore. He and Frank Zane should get together someday and see which one falls asleep first while they're spewing out verbal diarrhea. Wow. One negative comment. All right. Let's see. And then I sent some to my Patreon viewers, because I appreciate them. I sent them some photos that John Little sent me of Mike Mentzer. These were great photos. So let's see. I got some comments from some of those guys. Robert Brown said, the podcast was so good that I bought John's book, The Wisdom of Mike Mentzer, that same night. I am a big Mike Mentzer fan, and I was a member of the Nautilus Health Club the entire time they were in Wichita, Kansas. And Scott Barron also made a comment. He said, excellent interview and pictures. It's a damn shame about how Mike passed away at a relatively young age, followed by the death of his brother Ray just days later. Also, it seems that Mike experienced difficulties in his personal life after the 1980 Olympia until his unfortunate death in 2001. Perhaps Arnold should have just performed an awesome guest posing performance at the 1980 Olympia. His controversial seventh win was superfluous. Many fans would have claimed he could possibly have won without the enduring controversial win outcome. And Arnold could have claimed that he was focused upon acting as opposed to winning a superfluous seventh title. The 1980 Mr. Olympia devastated Mike Mentzer, and it derailed the momentum of numerous other bodybuilding careers. All right. And yeah, one thing John Little pointed out to me, which I thought was interesting, I never really thought about this regarding Arnold's comeback, was if you think about it, back then in 1980, we're going back 40 years, the networks, CBS, ABC, and NBC, were really, really big. If you look at the ratings that those shows got, like how many millions of people watched shows that were on the network television, at that time, there was no cable TV. I don't even think people were watching videotapes. So there was really no other form of entertainment. So if you watched TV, you were just watching one of those three networks. And Arnold had been out of bodybuilding for 5 years, and Conan was in production for a long time, but it was not being made. Arnold had not had a big hit ever. Pumping Iron was a small art house movie. And even though he did well in Stay Hungry, Stay Hungry was also a small movie and never made a lot of money. So the movie studios were putting a lot of money into Conan, and they were putting faith in Arnold as the leading man, but he really hadn't proved himself. So John Little said he thought Arnold may have gone into the 1980 Olympia to try to win it, like an easy win. He thought he would go in and just win easy. And the show would be on CBS television, and millions of people would see it. And if Conan came out like a year or two later, this would really help put Arnold into the focal point of the public eye again, because he had been out of competition for 5 years. So that does make a lot of sense when you think about how many people watched TV back then. And he would have been seen by millions of people. Unfortunately, the plan backfired. Arnold did win, but the win was so controversial that CBS didn't even air it. But Arnold did go on to make Conan. It was a huge hit. And, of course, Arnold's career was amazing. He had an unbelievable career as a movie star. And, unfortunately, Mike Mentzer's career went downhill after that. So that's the way it went. Crazy, crazy how it went. Anyways, that was a really enjoyable interview. And you guys are really going to enjoy part two coming up in a minute. All right. I also want to mention a few birthdays today. June 28th is Frank Zane's 78th birthday. So happy birthday to three-time Mr. Olympia, Frank Zane. And I did a great interview with Frank a couple months ago right here on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So if you haven't heard that, go back into the archives and check that out. Or you can go on to YouTube. I have it on my YouTube page under my name, John Hansen. Or if you have trouble finding it, just go to BodybuildingLegendsShow.com, which is our official website, and I have all my interviews, video interviews, and podcast interviews up at BodybuildingLegendsShow.com. Also, yesterday was Lance Dreher's birthday, and the day before that was Tom Platz's birthday, and they are both 65 years old this year. Tom and Lance both born in 1955. And earlier in the week, I think like Monday or Tuesday, was the beautiful Rachel McLish's birthday, the first Miss Olympia, two-time Miss Olympia, Rachel McLish, who is still beautiful at 62. So I posted all those birthdays on my Facebook page, because they're all legends, of course. And what a great week for birthdays, huh, in bodybuilding. Tom Platz, Lance Dreher, Rachel McLish, and Frank Zane, all in one week. All right, that's all I got. That's it for our opening. Here is our second part of our interview with John Little, author and writer from Flex Magazine. We're going to continue talking about Mike Mentzer, and then we're going to talk a little bit about Bruce Lee. Here we go.
Well, that's amazing. He was making $300,000 at his peak with his mail order.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's why I think he cut into Arnold's mail order marketing considerably.
Wow. Yeah.
Number one, Arnold wasn't probably making that and more, particularly when he was winning championships.
Hmm.
And then each year out of winning championships, I'm sure it went down a little bit despite, you know, his ads in the magazine. And then suddenly this tornado of fresh air blows through the corridors of bodybuilding.
Right.
Where, like you said, you know, train 3 days a week and five sets of body part. And people, their antenna went up. Yeah, I want to do that. I can do that. You know, I can invest that kind of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
so Mike serendipitously found himself doing very well with his bodybuilding courses.
And then especially when you consider like what a course costs, what is heavy duty book must have cost back then? What was it, $5 maybe?
Yeah, you know? $5-6. Yeah.
Yeah. So to make $300,000 a year, that's amazing. Yeah.
That's big turnover.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, that was an interesting period. Hey, I wanted to bring up an interesting thing here.
Sure.
Arthur Jones wrote an article, and I'm just trying to pull it up, 1972 Iron Man magazine.
Okay.
And the title was Some of the Problems and a Few of the Answers. And he looked at exercise and what you need. Later, L. Darden purloined the whole article and put it in the Advanced Bodybuilding book with his name on it. But nevertheless, this was Arthur's piece.
Okay.
And he said, I'll read it to you. Take a week off from training to give your system a chance to recover from its constantly overtrained condition. Then start back with three weekly workouts of only 12 sets each. That's right, not 12 sets of each exercise, but a total of only 12 sets of each of the following basic movements. Squats, standing presses, regular chin-ups, bench presses, standing barbell curls, parallel bar dips. Perform the exercises in that order. Use an amount of weight that will permit approximately 8 repetitions in good form, and increase the weight as soon as you can perform 10 or more repetitions without cheating. Blah, blah, blah. So essentially what you've got, where is it here? Oh, this is the point I wanted to get. 3 weeks on such a program should produce growth at a rate that will probably shock you. And when your rate of growth slows down again, then reduce your program to a schedule of only 2 such weekly workouts. Nowhere near enough. Don't knock it until you've tried it. Mike Mentzer, in 1974, this is 2 years after this article.
Okay.
He had injured his shoulder training. And he was forced to take a layoff for a period of time, and he got deconditioned. So he comes, he hits the gym again to try and build his muscle back. And this was an article called The Bodybuilding Strategy of Mike Mentzer by Rick Wayne.
Okay.
And Rick says, in 74, Mike had no fixed goal in mind except maybe to trim down somewhat. He remembers doing just 2 sets of body part, 10 sets per workout. He trained the whole body in one session, a session that comprised just 5 exercises. Sounds like Arthur's course.
Yeah.
He's quoting Mike. But the truth is, I started making such rapid progress, I was amazed. That, of course, says a lot about my genetic structure or maybe the efficacy of the form of training I was doing at the time, maybe both. Before you knew it, my mind was functioning correctly again, and I was thinking about competing. So this twice a week, 10 sets total, 2 sets per exercise.
5 exercises.
And he's almost ready to compete.
Wow.
So that's interesting. But what's further interesting is that many years later, I worked with the Bruce Lee Estate. And my interest was initially, how did he train? How did he develop his physique? Well, come to find out, 2 sets, basically the same program. He did clean and press, squats, pullovers, bench presses, good mornings, and barbell curls.
Yeah.
2 sets, about 8 to 12 repetitions. And one of his students who I knew, his name was Ted Wong.
Yeah.
And when Bruce met him, he said, you got to put some muscle on. And so he took Ted down to the Santa Monica, you know, department store, bought him a barbell set and a bench and some Hoffman's protein powder and had him do 2 sets, bench presses, press behind neck, deadlifts, bent over rows, squats, curls. And he said in 3 months, he went from 132 pounds to 147 pounds. total of 15 pounds gained, and he told me it was all muscle. He said, it's the heaviest I've ever been. So
now that was
these abbreviated programs.
That was Bruce that put his student on the program?
Same program that Bruce used, yeah.
Yeah.
So you have Mike Mentzer doing it, making great progress. Bruce doing it. His progress is legendary.
Yeah.
And his student, who gained 15 pounds of muscle.
Wow.
So the shorter, you know, three times a week or twice a week, abbreviated training programs have a history.
Yeah.
Not as sexy as a triple blitz, you know, that Weider would advocate.
Right.
You Tawny Weider Wildcats out there. But it was very effective and not really that dissimilar from your first barbell set program that came with your barbell set.
Yeah, you know,
like the York set or whatever.
Right.
Basically 3 days a week, maybe 10 or 12 sets of workout.
Yeah.
And that basic program has probably put more muscle on more people than any other program that we know of.
Right.
You know, and, you know, everything else is a footnote basically to DeLorme and Watkins and their three sets of 10, basically. So,
yeah. It was interesting too, when Mike was competing, he would always like update his training and he'd be like, well, you know, I found that I need more recuperation now because I'm training heavier or I'm starting to do rest pause. I'm bringing that into it, you know. And he would constantly be updating it as we followed his career. You know, I remember like when he was training for probably the 80 Olympia, which was his last contest, he was constantly updating, you know, his training.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, to my knowledge, there were certain protocols that Mike actually created. I think Infotonic was one of those, which, if I'm not mistaken, involved a maximum positive followed by a maximum negative on the way down. Some call it hyper reps now.
Yeah.
He also did omni contraction, which was a cool concept. It was maximum positive. And then on the way down, during the negative phase, you pause at three distinct places statically to work the muscles there.
Okay.
So omni, all contraction, you know, it was positive, negative, and static. And rest pause, to my knowledge, he was the first bodybuilder to incorporate that into his training. Certainly the first to publicize it.
Yeah.
He was an innovator in that respect, and he was not chained to orthodoxy. You know, he was an iconoclast. He thought outside of the box.
Yeah.
And you and I had been corresponding recently, and we were wondering about the enduring claim that he had gained 10 pounds of muscle between the 79 Olympia and the 80 Olympia.
Yeah.
And I remember an article, I can't get my hand on it, but he also told me that he had used hydrostatic weighing during this period of time. And I think he'd gained 11 pounds of muscle, but it was incorporating these intense methods. And the reason he incorporated them was, you know, the body will do whatever it can to conserve energy first and foremost.
Yeah.
And it learns very quickly, no matter what you do, if it becomes a routine, it's going to figure out a way to do it with less energy output, which essentially means less fiber involved. It can conserve its energy stores. But you probably have experienced this yourself. You're doing a program for a while and you introduce an exercise you haven't done in 10 years. And suddenly it's like, wow, did I ever feel that?
Yeah.
Well, in my book, The Time Savers Workout, I refer to that as the conservation of energy phenomenon, because I couldn't think of a shorter phrase, but it essentially, when you do something you haven't done in a while or you do something new, your body is all in. It doesn't know you're doing an exercise.
Yeah.
It just knows that suddenly your energy output is, you know, gone from this to that.
Yeah.
So this is serious. So all in, you know, all systems go.
Right.
So you're bringing in fibers you normally wouldn't use and probably don't really need for that exercise. It's like first time you drove a standard automobile. You were probably exhausted because every muscle was tight and you're gripping the wheel and you're working the clutch and you're looking in the mirrors and you never want to do it again. But a month later, it's effortless. You're driving down the road and it's not that you've gotten stronger because you've done it. It's just your body has now learned it didn't need that much muscle activity to do this job.
So
now it just brings in just the fibers that are required at just the second they're required to work the clutch and work the stick.
Right.
I believe the same is true with training, with exercise, that your body will adapt. And it doesn't want to put an ounce of muscle on you. It has no interest in that. Muscle, from the body's perspective, is the stupidest thing you could build. Because it's energy-hungry tissue that needs more energy to sustain it.
You're right.
We're a species that faced starvation up until the turn of the last century.
Right.
So our bodies programmed us for two things. One is, if you don't have to output energy, don't, because you may not get it back.
Right.
And two, if you come upon energy, consume it, because it may not be there tomorrow.
Mm.
And we wonder why we have an obesity epidemic. But that's how we're programmed. And the only difference is we've taken that creature from when the DNA was encoded for those impulses and plunked them down into an environment now of food abundance where, you know, when you and I finish talking, I can get in my car and go down the road and pick up 5,000 calories like that.
Right,
so
right.
Our ancestors didn't have that luxury. They were lucky to get 800 calories out of the surroundings.
You know? Right, right. Yeah. So,
a study they did on walking where they, because a lot of people walk, you're going to burn some calories, you know, get out and walk. And they measured with urinalysis and whatever other tests they did. And they found, yes, indeed, they burned X amount of calories when they did their walk. And then they put them in an exoskeleton so that the gait, their walking pattern, was compromised. So it was more difficult to walk. And yes, lo and behold, they burned more calories doing this. But the very next time they got in the exoskeleton, the calorie output was right down to what it was before. The body had adapted that quickly.
Wow.
So I think there is an application there even in bodybuilding where it's, you know, the big picture is change your program around.
Yeah. Yeah. You
know, it doesn't hurt to add some volume sometimes because that represents a novel stimulus to the body.
Right.
But a steady diet of volume will wear out your joints.
You know, right. So. Right. Yeah. John, I wanted to ask you about Mike's ending. You know, after that 80 Olympia, he was so disappointed with what happened there. He was done with bodybuilding. And like you said, he really loved bodybuilding. So his mail order course, was he out of the magazines after that point, after that 80 Olympia?
Not immediately. But what happened was Mike was the most vociferous that the contest was fixed.
Yeah.
When he came back. Because he was honest. If you asked him, he told you. If an interviewer asked him, he told him what he thought.
Yeah.
And he was categorical. The contest was fixed. There's no way Arnold should have won it.
Yeah.
Well, the way bodybuilding was structured back then, where you had Ben Weider running the league, the IFBB, Joe running the promotional arm and the magazine and the supplement business, and you have a guy saying that Arnold shouldn't have won that contest, that it was fixed, that doesn't reflect well on the IFBB, which is already looking to get Olympic acceptance.
Yeah.
Any whiff of corruption is, you don't want to touch it.
Right.
So Ben Weider was not pleased with what Mike was saying. The second thing was, after about his second year in Los Angeles, he stopped doing ads for Joe because he recognized these protein supplements are not, you're basically telling these young bodybuilders that if they throw all this money month after month after month on these consumable products, they're going to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he goes, that's bullshit. He said, and he felt strongly about that because he was victimized by that himself when he was younger. So he stopped doing the ads for Weider's protein. Well, if you piss on Ben's shoes and say that his contest is corrupt, and you tell Joe, I'm not hawking your products.
Yeah.
They have no use for him. I mean, right. All they do is open up another can of bodybuilders. There's no shortage of muscle men in California.
Right.
And so it didn't matter what Mike's message was. It didn't matter whether or not he spoke the truth. What mattered was the business. And this is not good for business. And that was pointed out to Joe, that you got a guy who you're giving a lot of space to who is not endorsing the Weider system. He's more in line with what Arthur Jones is peddling over there in Florida.
Yeah.
Plus, Arthur's selling machines. You're selling barbells. How is this guy an asset to you?
Right.
And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a business. It has nothing to do with, you know, bodybuilding is important for nation building and all this other nonsense that, you know, the leaders used to spout out. It was about turning a buck. And if this guy was not for them and the enterprise, then he was against them. And if you're against us, see ya. So he didn't, suddenly his seminars dried up because most of the guys that owned the gyms in these different countries that brought people in, like Albert Busek, for example, in Germany.
Yeah.
They were the Weider distributors in their respective countries.
Right.
So do you want a guy that's going to come in and said, no, you don't need Weider supplements? Or are you going to bring in the latest champ du jour? He goes, oh, yeah, Yeah. Omega weight gain powder number four is crash weight gain. That's what you need.
Right.
So, and that's the way bodybuilding has gone on. In that one interview that Mike said, he said, you know, I'm not stupid enough to think the pulse of bodybuilding is going to skip a beat because I'm gone. And he was right.
Right.
It didn't.
Right.
It was people like me who thought, geez, this guy had something important to say. And you've silenced him that were left pissed off, you know.
Yeah.
And then when you see what could have happened, or you speculate what could have happened, had you look at two careers, Arnold, he's on the ascendant for his film career and bodybuilding. Mike's coming up like a rocket. I mean,
yeah,
he was in GQ magazine. He was on the Merv Griffin show. He was publishing books. He wrote his own articles, unlike Arnold.
Right.
And there's that collision point in the 1980 Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
And Arnold's star goes on, and Mike's goes down.
Right.
And he was the only guy. It was like, if there's corruption and status quo, and let's keep selling supplements and all the other stuff we're doing, that's on the Arnold rocket. And here comes, you know, the antidote to that, and it's shot out of the sky before it gets there. And it's like,
wow.
You know.
Yeah.
And right back, it went right back to the way it was and always has been.
Yeah.
So you mentioned he was upset. Yeah, he was upset. He was more upset, not that he lost the contest or didn't win the contest, although that would have made a big difference. You know, would have kept his mail order quite high and revenue high. But what it did is it ripped the veil off. It's like the Wizard of Oz. He saw who was behind the curtain.
Yeah.
This noble enterprise of building your body and your mind simultaneously, because you use your mind to figure out a better way to train, a better way to diet, and then use your body as the lab. And if you succeed, it's a check mark in both boxes. You know, the mind is stronger, the body is stronger.
Yeah.
The bodybuilding to Mike Mentzer was the noblest pursuit on the face of the earth. It was the greatest thing anybody could engage in. And the competitive aspect was thrilling, and it was more exciting than football or anything else. Bodybuilding was it.
Yeah.
And it's like someone who is profoundly religious, and doesn't matter what the religion is, but whatever it is, they're all in. And suddenly the rug's ripped out from under them, and you realize that, you know, their pastor is corrupt and doesn't believe in what he's saying, and it's all smoke and mirrors in order to get the collection plate money, duping these people. That's how it hit Mike, because he had his suspicions from some contests where he thought, you know, I should have won that. But he never said, oh, you know, it was ripped off or it was fixed. He just thought that was a weird decision. Like in 79, when he was winning the prejudging and he lost to Zane overall. And he could accept that, but he went to the judges because his attitude was, what can I do differently?
Yeah.
If there's something I'm missing, I want to know about it. As he once said, I'm more interested in the truth than being proven right or wrong. You know, he said, the truth is our best friend. He said, if someone could convince me that all my thoughts on training are nonsense and that the really rational way to train is this, he said, I'd be all over it. That's what I do.
Yeah.
But anyway, he went to one of the judges who happened to be Reg Park and said, you know, Reg, what was the problem? How do I lose when I was ahead in the prejudging? And a lot of people have speculated, oh, he was posing too fast at the end. That was the pose down. That should mean nothing.
Right.
At that point of the contest. That's when the judges are tabulating the scores. So, you know, you would expect that answer from Reg. You know, you moved too fast, you did this, you did that. Reg said, no, when you did your pose where you put your arms out, you took up the whole stage. People aren't ready for that. And Mike was taken aback. He thought, well, you, of all people, were known for your mass. That's what influenced Arnold. And now you're telling me it's a liability, not an asset.
Right.
He couldn't. But anyway, he accepted that. And in his mind, he thought, okay, bodybuilding now, obviously it's going to be more Zane-esque, more highly defined. So he did that. I mean, he was on, well, as Boyer told you, he was down to 500 calories a day.
Yeah.
He told me that he had actually at one point drained his ATP stores. He said he was in bed for a couple of days before the Olympics. He said, I couldn't raise my arm without being out of breath. But then, you know, but so think about that commitment. Where, you know, it's almost a near-death experience, but you're going to starve yourself for this ideal.
Yeah.
And so did the other bodybuilders, for that matter. Like Roger Walker, who was also passionate when you spoke to him.
Right.
He put his heart and soul into it. And then to find out, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter how you look. We've already got the thing figured out.
Right.
He's going to win because he's going to do movies. And just like when Steve Reeves did movies, we kept him on the cover and we sold more magazines.
Right.
We sold more barbell sets and more protein product. It was a business decision.
Yeah.
And with Mike, it was the first, it was just the shock of the corruption that this was possible.
Mm-hmm.
Danny Padilla in another podcast said it, and I thought he was quite poignant when he said it. He said, for Mike, it was all about defending the sport. And, because he and Boyer both told Mike, like, why are you quitting? Like, you've got the physique. The Olympia is yours. All you got to do is go and compete for it. You know you're going to win it at some point.
Yeah.
And he just at that point, he knew the sport was sullied. He knew that there was corruption at play. And if he won, would it be legitimate? Mm. Would his victory be legitimate? Or was it already been predetermined because of something else?
Yeah.
And that put him off. His passion, his love for the sport had been taken away from him at that point. I think he was waiting to see if the ship would right itself the next year. But then the 81 Olympia happened.
Right.
And it was like, there it is.
Yeah.
So, it wasn't sour grapes. Sour grapes is usually when you try to downplay something that someone else has that you really want, but you don't want to show it.
Mm.
That's the old Aesop's fable, right, about the sour grapes. It wasn't that. Mike never once said, I don't want to win the Olympia. Oh, it's not that big to me. You know, who cares if I won or lost that contest? It was quite the opposite. This bodybuilding was a big thing. It was important to him. And I think when he found out that it was not on the up and up and that business decisions of one stripe or another were influencing results of contests, he said, I'm done. I can't countenance it anymore. But unfortunately, all his eggs were in that basket since he was a kid. Bodybuilding, Bill Pearl, Arnold Schwarzenegger, all these guys. He was in. Like, that was his religion. That was his pantheon. That was everything to him.
Yeah.
And when that was rooted out, he was unmoored for a little bit. What's next? Who do you turn to? He still loved training, and he took great pride and joy in sharing whatever knowledge he had with anyone who was interested in it, often at no cost. But that thrill was gone. I remember him telling me that he said, I really miss the high-intensity lifestyle, he said, where contests and traveling and getting in shape and going to different countries and meeting new people, and it seemed that business opportunities were always presenting themselves to you, too. You're over there and nobody knows who you are anymore.
Yeah.
And it's a weird phenomenon. And you and I have been muscle heads, since we were much younger. And so we know Larry Scott. We know Lee Haney. We know Lee Labrador. We know all these different, by Flex Wheeler, Sean Ray, all these guys throughout the history of bodybuilding, back to John Grimmick. And before that, I shouldn't say that. I obviously don't know before John Grimmick, but Grimmick and Reeves and all those guys.
Yeah.
But if you leave your house right now and you stop the first person on the street you encounter and say, who's Mr. Olympia? You're going to get, I don't know. Nobody knows.
Right.
But to us, it's like, how can you not know who this? We are a very, very small subculture.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that is distressing about the 80 Olympia was that the sport was breaking out. It was on the major networks. They were broadcasting bodybuilding contests. Regular American folks knew the names of these bodybuilders.
Right.
And then after 80, they pulled the plug. They weren't broadcasting another show, and they never have. What kind of damage did that do to bodybuilding? It put their boot right on the throat of bodybuilding. That was it. They're little backroom deals or however it played out was enough that bodybuilding took a nosedive. It was on the way up. It should have, I think Mike would agree. It had the opportunity for him to proselytize how great this is. Look at these physiques. Look at the Robbie Robinsons, look at the Boyer Coes. That opportunity was denied the public, and consequently the door closed on it. And in 81, the same thing. And You know, it's just when you think what could have been,
yeah,
could have been run on the up and up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to hear that because we always hear of Mentzer as the example of a guy who took a contest decision too hard and he let it ruin his life. But it really was more
than that. It wasn't it. It was deeper. It was deeper than that. It was the bigger picture.
Yeah.
He told me before, he said, you know, it wasn't about losing a contest. He said, I've lost contests before.
Right.
He said, that you learn from it. He said, I never made a fuss about, you know, losing to Cal Skalik or any of these guys. He said, these are great champions. He said, so that was part of my learning process, coming up and learning how to do that. And like I mentioned before, you know, Robbie Robinson, Robbie had beaten him, Mike had beaten Robbie, but he learned from all of those things and the competition and even the camaraderie, I think, and trying to see if he tries this new technique based on those principles, will it result in a better effect for him or a, you know, worse effect? Or it was a laboratory where every day you were learning something, you know? And the fact that he lost the 80 Olympia, I don't think was an issue. I think if he'd lost to Boyer Coe or Chris Dickerson, he would have nodded and said, they were in great shape. They were in top condition.
Yeah.
And I'll try and come in top condition next year. But it was the corruption in 80 and perhaps an even greater corruption in 81, although I think the 80 was the biggie because, again, it was the first time the public now recognized that there might be corruption in bodybuilding at some level.
Yeah.
And then 80 just confirmed it.
Yeah.
So, you know, like he saw, if that's the way contests, he told me, he said, you have to have a goal. He said, every bodybuilder wants to win, he said.
Yeah.
And you have to have an unobstructed goal to try and go for, he said. But when there are obstructions placed in the way that are going to bar you from doing that, he said, you got to recognize it's over. You can't do it.
Yeah.
And so that's what he did.
Hmm.
But
it's been 40 years now since that 80 Olympia, and it's still probably incredible. The most talked about Olympia ever.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, for people like me who are friends of Mike, you know, we like to entertain the fantasy, what would have happened if Mike had won.
Yeah.
And I think the message of less frequent workouts, briefer workouts, would have predominated.
Yeah.
It would have been accepted instead of being, you know, as we still find ourselves to this day, you know, we're screaming from the mountaintops and people aren't too interested because the current Mr. O trains this way.
Right.
That's the way the wind's blowing. It's a weather vane effect, really.
Right.
Whatever champions, whatever they're doing, whatever way the wind's blowing, that's what people are doing.
Yeah.
But Mike was always about there's something more to it than this, you know, and there was more to it in training. There, you know, if we apply ourselves, we can find out what the truth is for human beings in training.
Yeah.
He once said, you know, people that say we have different training requirements are entirely wrong. He said, when a young man or woman goes to medical school to study muscle physiology, he goes, whose physiology are they studying? Everybody's. So because we all have the same muscle physiology.
Right.
He said, therefore, it follows that the stimulus required to induce, you know, hypertrophy in Mike Mentzer is the same as in you and you and you and everybody else listening here.
Right.
So, I mean, that would have been an interesting thing to entertain, an interesting fantasy to entertain had Mike won, but he didn't. The reality is he didn't. He was relegated to fifth place.
Yeah.
Arnold won, and tens of millions of dollars of protein supplements have been sold since then. I remember, speaking of which, when I was with Joe, I went out for lunch with Joe Weider.
Okay.
It was 93 or 94, maybe. And he had just sold, he and Ben owned their supplement company. And they just sold half of it to some company. I could be wrong. But I believe the amount was about $200 or $300 million. And he excused himself to go to the bathroom while we were having lunch. And he left a suit jacket sort of flopped over the back of his chair. And in the breast pocket, he had a check for $1 million, which he hadn't cashed yet.
Wow.
But that's the kind of money we're talking about that was floating around bodybuilding and the business of bodybuilding.
Wow.
It's no secret that people want to get into the supplement business. I haven't met anyone in the bodybuilding industry who doesn't want to come out with supplements.
Right.
Because they're consumables. You have to go back every month and keep paying the money.
Right.
And the money is massive. It is I think the supplement business is about, last I saw, a $6 billion a year industry. So, you know, you have a guy saying, oh, you don't need that. You know, eat a well-balanced diet and train intensely, briefly, and infrequently.
Right.
Where's the money in it?
You know, right.
Like, no, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear that I got to take, you know, spirulina or whatever the hell their form of protein they're hawking these days. And, you know, and I got to work out 6 days a week. And if you're not making gains, it's because now you got to work out with this other program that we're selling, you know. And it's all emperor's new clothes, you know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Mike, again, as we spoke about, his candor was such that he was more interested in trying to get the truth out to those naive young bodybuilders who otherwise might be duped.
Right.
But, man, that was the wrong marketplace to be selling that message.
Right. Well, Mike did get to see Dorian Yates win, though. And Dorian, you know, watched it.
Yeah, that was nice. It was kind of a vindication of sorts.
Yeah.
Of his beliefs, at least with regard to training intensity and frequency. And I witnessed two of those workouts. I was there when Mike put Dorian through.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, two workouts. You know, it's not taking anything away from Dorian. It's funny, after Dorian won the Olympia, his people immediately said, distance yourself from Mensur, mm-hmm. because you got to create your own ethos. This is, you don't know how long you're going to have on the stage here.
Yeah.
Make your money, which Mike totally got. You know, he said, you know, Dorian's got to take this opportunity. And, you know, if he's seen as too close to me, then it's going to benefit me. It's not going to benefit him. So
right.
you know, I wish him well on that. But, the cool thing was that Dorian Yates, who was phenom in bodybuilding, you know, openly said that, you know, Mike was an influence and that he had, his Mike's articles meant something to him.
Yeah.
At that point. That was cool because up until that point, Mike was being vilified, essentially, ignored or vilified. That was the only two things. To be taken seriously by a guy of Dorian's stature came out of left field. And I remember I went to cover, was in Helsinki, was that 92?
Yeah, 92. Was that
Dorian's first Olympia? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to cover that. So I was very interested to see what high intensity training did for Dorian Yates.
Yeah.
And he looked great, you know, and Mike was more surprised than anyone when he got news that Dorian won. He said, I would have thought because of, you know, that, you know, oblique connection to me, that would have been enough to put them off. He said, but I was really happy for him, you know, that it was, and happy even when he wasn't really associated with him, to see Dorian continue to train hard and intense and to keep winning championships. So
yeah,
it was a slight vindication, I think, for Mike. You know,
yeah.
His ideas got taken seriously again.
Yeah. I just got Dorian's new autobiography, and he's got a whole big chapter in there about Mike, and he's got pictures of
him. Oh, does he?
Nautilus preacher curl, like our bicep curl, and Mike's on there, you know, helping him out with it and stuff. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I saw him do that. He had him doing one arm curls on the Omni machine, and he pinned another 25 pounds to the stack.
Right.
And
then
I think he had him doing static holds with it as well.
Okay. Yeah.
But, I mean, I went into the room at Gold's with Mike and Dorian after Dorian had done a chest and biceps workout with Mike, and Dorian was wearing his sweats and he peeled them off. And I mean, he was huge. I've never seen lats. Like, I mean, there almost wasn't room for me in the room when he flexed his lats, you know? And, it was cool. Mike looked at him with a fair degree of pride, you know, because he knew it was Dorian's efforts that did it.
Yeah.
And he applauded that. Anybody that thought for themselves, worked hard, didn't care what the crowd said about how to train or anything.
Right.
Put his head down, worked hard, and there's the results of using your brain to guide your training. So he was more pleased about that almost than Dorian winning the competition, was that he had built this amazing physique by the application of his reason to training, if you will.
Yeah. Was that the picture, John, where Dorian's standing there with like his underwear on and Mike's standing right? Yeah.
Yeah. I should send you the ones I took from that photo session. They're pretty interesting.
Yeah.
They were several ones. The other, Icarian bench press, incline press, and he had the stack plus 245s or something on each side for negatives because it was Mike and two other guys were helping lift the weight, and then Dorian was lowering it.
Okay.
I mean, his pecs looked like Zeppelins, you know, when he finished. It was crazy.
Yeah. Crazy.
It was a pretty cool time.
Yeah. Well, John, before you go, I want to ask you a little bit about Bruce Lee because I'm a big Bruce Lee fan. I got into Bruce Lee before I got into bodybuilding. So
you and me both.
Yeah. You've done lots of books about him. You've done videos about him. Talk a little bit about Bruce Lee. And you know what's really interesting when you look at Bruce Lee's short life, how much his physique improved so much, like when he was in Kato, and then when he got into the martial arts movies that he made in Hong Kong, especially Enter the Dragon, of course, but how his physique improved so much. So do you think that was a direct result of him being interested in bodybuilding and buying the magazines and, you know, maybe doing art?
Yeah, he'd started buying the magazines in the mid to late 60s, Strength and Health, Muscular Development, Joe's magazines. And he clipped out articles by, you know, training articles, Iron Man. And he had them in a gray folder. And
really?
I went through it once and made a list of what all the articles were. But, yeah, he was in with both feet in bodybuilding. He thought bodybuilding was great. You know, and it was never his goal, nor did he have the genetics to be huge.
Yeah.
But because I remember he was and another student of his were walking down in Santa Monica by the dungeon, the old gym. They called the dungeon down there. And some huge guy came out. I don't know who it was. Might have been Dave Draper.
Yeah, and one on the beach, right, on Santa Monica Beach.
Yeah, and the guy said, "Whoa, who see the size of that guy, Bruce?" But he said, "Yeah, you know, but you know, is he powerful? Meaning, can you use that quickly?"
Yeah.
So his big thing was getting the muscles stronger, but to use them in a practical way. I think the muscular development. He was proud of his physique, no question about it. But that was almost a side effect of his objective. He had tremendous lats, but he had those since he was a teenager. You know, again, genetics. Tiny waist. His forearms were bigger than his biceps by about 1 or 2 inches.
Wow.
His abs were developed. It wasn't just that there was no body fat there and you could see his abs. There actually were, you talk about fiber density, he had the ridges.
Yeah.
Same with his pecs. He had pretty good pecs too.
Yeah.
And then what happened when he went to Hong Kong was the humidity sweat out all the water, all the interstitial water, and he wasn't eating as much, so he was like dieting. And then by the time Enter the Dragon rolled around, it was like a skinned cat.
You know? Yeah,
never seen that kind of definition before.
Right,
but he never. I mean, I think it is the most he weighed when he was, you know, taking his Bob Hoffman protein powder and pumping the iron 3 days a week. He was about 145.
Yeah.
By the time he made Enter the Dragon, because of the humidity and the choreography and all of this stuff, he was 120.
Wow. So, 120.
Yeah. Unbelievable. 5'7.5", 120 pounds.
Jeez.
But insane power. Like James Coburn, I remember he and I were in a room waiting to go on. They were doing a documentary on Bruce and they were interviewing, you know, different people that were there. I think Van Williams from the Green Hornet was there.
Yeah.
And him and myself, because I'd written a book, and we were talking, or actually we were talking, but not about that. When he went on camera, James Coburn revealed an anecdote where he said Bruce had an 85-pound Everlast canvas punching bag hung in the backyard. Hung it in Coburn's backyard. He said, "This is for you to work out on." And he said, "I'll break it in for you." And he said, Bruce hit it with a sidekick without running, just sidekick. He said, ripped a hole in the bag that big. He said the stuffing came out of it and it snapped the chain that was holding the bag.
Holy
the bag went
shit.
Into the yard. And he studied mechanics a lot. Like he was, if you watch and analyze his movement, it's all the physics behind it. A lot of hip, you know, generating power into stuff he did. Even his 1-inch punch.
Yeah.
It all comes from the hips and the legs.
Yeah. You know?
But it's, he was phenomenally fast. And unlike a lot of our heroes and movie star action heroes, he was the real deal.
Yeah.
In fact, if anything, he was a better fighter in real life than he was in his movies.
Wow.
So he was everything you thought he was.
Yeah.
I've spoken to people that saw him fight for real and that it saw him spar good fighters. And they all said, we couldn't touch him. There was like, he was just so fast. I remember there was a fellow that worked in Black Belt Magazine's warehouse. I want to say his name was Mark Wong. And we got to be friends. And one day we got to talking. I said, "Oh, you worked at Black Belt." I said, "Bruce Lee used to go there all the time. You must have seen him." He goes, "Oh yeah, saw him a lot." I said, "Do you remember anything about him?" He goes, "Yeah, a couple things." He goes, "One," he said, "he was skinny." He said, "He looked skinny and he was cocky. He seemed cocky to me." He said, "Now I grew up in East LA." He said, "And I was in street gangs and all that stuff. And we were, you know, we fought a lot." So, you know, the fact that he was Kato didn't impress me. And I guess when Bruce left, Mark spoke to the owner of the magazine, a guy by the name of Mito Uehara.
Yeah.
And told him his thoughts. You know, it was a skinny guy doing back here. And Mito said, "Well, you don't think he can fight?" And he said, "No." He goes, "You know, one kick, the guy'd blow away, basically." You know? And he said, "Well, what do you, are you a fighter?" He goes, "Yeah, I box and I do this." He goes, "Oh, okay." So anyway, I guess 3 or 4 days pass and Bruce walks back into the warehouse where this guy is. And he says, "Hey, I understand you're a boxer." And he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, let's box. You know, come on, let's see what you can do." And he said Bruce was 15 feet away from him. He said he was in, slapped him in the head, was back out in 15 feet before the guy knew what happened. So, okay, let's do that again. You know, Bruce did it again. Bang, back. And then Bruce said, "Well, listen, you don't seem to be much of a boxer." He said, "What?" He said, "Let's see a kick." So he had an air shield, and the guy kicked it. And Bruce said, "Well, that's okay." He goes, "Here, hold this." And air shield's like those old football ones you used
right,
to
wear, right.
You
know? That he used
and that. The guy said, same thing. No run, no nothing. He said, "Bruce Lee kicked me." He said, "I went 25 feet back." He said, "I've been hit by a car before." He said, "And this hurt more than that." Jeez. So it was, I mean, he was a phenom. He was a generational talent that just you don't see very often.
Yeah.
Super smart, super fit.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a time I owned his Marcy circuit trainer, the machine that he had imported to Hong Kong. It was like a universal machine, multi-station unit.
Uh-huh.
And he used to train on it. So that was kind of cool when I used to work out on that. You know,
yeah.
It was Bruce's, but
anyway,
I don't own that anymore, but it was, he was into that. And Walter Marcian, who owned Marcy Equipment, had designed that. And again, the bodybuilding connection, you know, the Marcy Equipment was all over gyms back in the day. So Bruce was plugged into that.
Wow. That's awesome. When I just watched that Last Dance, the documentary about Michael Jordan and the Bulls. And, you know, when I was watching that, I was thinking, you know, because Michael Jordan was a really hard worker and he really wanted to win. He had a lot of desire. But I was thinking how much of his success was due to his genetics, his natural ability to be a good basketball player, and how much was due to his hard work. And I always thought that about Bruce Lee, too, because I know Bruce Lee was, like, totally dedicated. I remember he had that huge library of books. And like you said, he would study all these different fighting styles. He would run the films backwards, and he would study the mechanics, like you said, and things like that. And his training was, like, so crazy. But you wonder, like, how much of his speed and stuff was genetic, his reflexes and things, you know?
I think a lot of it, it's like most things, you know, from eye color to height to skin pigmentation to athletic aptitude, it's all genetic. Or at least it's a huge component.
Yeah.
But a lot of people can have the genetic gift, but they don't know it, and they don't go into an activity that allows it to express itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just kind of diminishes and atrophies, and you never hear about it.
Yeah.
Other people, for some reason, get attracted to a sport that they are genetically wired to be amazing at.
Yeah.
And when they train, they get even more amazing at it.
Yeah.
And I think that was Bruce Lee. I mean, his speed, I mean, there's no secret to his training methods. They've been out for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen anyone duplicate his speed yet.
Right.
So, I mean, Bruce would have been slower if he didn't train the way he did, but he'd still be ridiculously fast.
Yeah.
But when that's married with resistance training, so you have a, you know, stronger, more powerful strike.
Right.
It's almost unfathomable. I remember talking to a Pan Am gold medalist in judo who was also a third or fourth dan in Shotokan karate. and his name is Hayward Nishioka, and worked at Cal State for a while, taught there, but phenomenal judo man, like top of the heap. And, you know, most martial artists, when you talk about Bruce, they downplay his attributes because they feel they don't look as good by comparison. So if they diminish Bruce, you know, what you're left with is
yeah.
the real deal. So Hayward didn't have an ego. He was awesome that way. I mean, he won enough championships. He didn't need to, you know, concoct an right. image for himself. But I said, what was it like with Bruce? He said, well, sparring with him, he goes, was ridiculous because you couldn't do anything. He said, you know, I'm high up there in judo. I'm high up there in karate. He said, I couldn't. He said, it was like he was psychic. He said, he knew what I was going to do before I did it, and he would shut me down. Mm. And he'd be in and he'd be out like he was with the guy in the warehouse, and I couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
And he said, he was so fast. And the other thing was, he said, he hit me with this 1-inch punch. And he said, and I'm thinking, as I'm flying backwards 15 feet into a wall and sliding down the wall, he goes, I'm a Pan Am gold medal. How the hell is this happening? And he said, you know, I got so pissed off and frustrated sparring with him or trying to spar with him. I said, yeah, Bruce, I'm not doing this. Bruce said, what's up? And he said, yeah, I can't do anything. This is ridiculous. He said, what? He goes, you know, my game is judo. He said, you know, I'm on the ground, arm bars, locks, chokes. He goes, what would you do if I just lay down on the ground, waited for you? He said, well, I wouldn't do anything. He said, but don't get up. You know? So it may be true that, you know, 80% of the fights end up on the ground, but it's also true 100% of them start standing up. So right. Bruce had a pretty good stand-up game. And he actually wasn't bad in grappling, but his big thing was it should be over quickly.
Yeah.
Like
you
don't want to drag this out because that's when things can go wrong that you didn't plan for.
Right.
And
right.
So he was lightning fast, but he also had power with the speed, which is just rare, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
One of his early students, Jesse Glover, told me that I forget what the timing was, but they timed him and it was like so quick. It was in hundreds and hundreds of a second for a strike. And he'd hit a catcher's mask. And it was caved in when he hit it. At that speed, bam. So he said at that point, he said, we knew that if Bruce actually punched someone, he would kill him.
Hmm.
He said, that's, you know, everyone talks about his kicks. He said, but man, he said, if Bruce punched you, it would have been lights. You would have been dead. You know,
so, wow. Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, push-ups on thumbs only.
Phenomenal.
One finger of one arm. Guy's body awareness was off the charts.
Yeah. And even his ab exercises where he's raising his whole body up and stuff, you know?
Yeah, where he did that almost look like a bridge with his legs, those leg raises. Yeah. Yeah, no, he was in phenomenal condition. Yeah,
what a phenomenon. You wonder, like, you know, Mensur's last show, I think it was just 29, right, when he did the 89 Olympia.
So his age, you mean, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So you wonder if Mensur would have kept going, how, you know, what Bruce Lee would have accomplished in the movies if he would have stayed alive.
He was only 32 when he died.
I know.
And, I mean, he was really just kind of hitting a stride.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Enter the Dragon came out after he died, right? So
yeah, and it was like, wow. And it left everybody hungry for more, but there was no more coming.
There was no more. And, I know.
It's funny. I remember, to tie it to Mike, I was working on a documentary on Bruce Lee in around 1999, 2000. I was in California. And I called Mike. I think we were going to get together, and I told him what I was doing. He goes, oh, Bruce Lee. He goes, man, I was a huge Bruce Lee fan growing up, you know?
So
we used to talk about him in high school all the time. And he asked me to write an article for his website on Bruce's training, which I did. But, Mike was a huge Bruce Lee guy. I thought he was just, you know, so cool.
Yeah.
But again, it spoke to things that Mike liked. Bruce was iconoclastic.
He
didn't like tradition.
He was, right.
Mike was iconoclastic. He didn't like tradition.
Right.
So he, you know, what Bruce did, he did on his own.
Yeah.
He was self-taught, basically.
Yeah.
And
he challenged the traditions of martial arts. Yeah.
And I mean, I see parallels with Mike and Bruce
right
across the board in that respect. You know,
right.
Arnold was the upholder of tradition. And most bodybuilding was tradition, still is.
Yeah. Yep.
And most martial arts are tradition-based and still are.
Yeah.
And Bruce was the one who said, no, it's a style or a method he likened to a cage because If you do boxing, you can only use your hands. If you do judo or grappling, it's joint locks and throws and things like that. You never see a judo man doing a high kick.
Right.
If you're doing it, it's not judo.
You know? Right.
And so right. Bruce's thing was you need to be free yourself of any restrictions because you don't know how an opponent's going to come at you.
Yeah.
So you need to be able to use any potential weapon at your disposal, your knees, your hands, your head, your feet. And you can't be passive. You can't wait for someone to come in like they do in certain arts and use the opponent's force against them. Not yeah. that that's a bad thing. That could come in handy. But if you make that, you put all your eggs in that basket and your opponent doesn't come in that way, what do you got? You
know? Yeah.
So
yeah.
he sure. was all about, you know, develop your own spontaneous response, like echo to sound to an opponent's move or technique.
Yeah.
So it's not preordained. Like you see these YouTube videos where the instructor will say, I'm going to show you how to defend against a knife strike. Like, you know, like you should be practicing that. And his student will take a knife and he'll come at him in a way that no attacker ever would.
Right.
And then he'll do a freeze frame.
Right.
You know, there it is. And then the instructor goes, and he spins yeah. around, and the guy's still in this tableau, you know, right. and like this is realistic. But, and Bruce used to scoff at that sort of stuff. He just said, you know, I remember one interview he was talking about, he said, you know, if you read these courses, because they didn't have YouTube back then, he said, you know, you're told that if someone grabs you, you do this, and then you do this, and then
right.
do that. Said so you do it, you know, 1,000 moves, you know, and he said, but if some guy grabs you, just stomp on his instep. He said, he'll let you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't need that stuff, you know?
Right.
And I think his thinking outside of the box and thinking as an individual, there is a parallel there with what Mike did in bodybuilding. Cause he did the same thing. He
yeah.
wasn't a traditionalist.
Right.
And thought for himself. And I think in some respects, that's probably why he kind of gave a knowing nod to Dorian Yates when his success came, because Dorian did a similar thing.
Yeah, yeah, Dorian, same way.
Individuals respect individuals.
You know? Right, and, right.
As we talked about at the beginning, maybe before we started the formal talk, that a great quote of Mike's that I always liked was that, you know, the conformist does what he does because everybody else does it.
Right.
And the nonconformist says, I'm not going to do it because you guys are doing it.
Right.
So the individualist says, I'm doing it because I can see for myself the reasons that it's true.
Yeah.
And that was Bruce Lee and that was Mike Manzer.
Right. Right. That's great. Well, John, I want to thank you for joining us on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. This was a fascinating discussion. And I
hope
it's
great to talk to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Great to talk to you.
Like I know you because I've watched your chat show for on YouTube so often, but I got to say you're a great interviewer.
Thank you.
But you're even more interesting when you're being interviewed. So give me a heads up when you're being interviewed.
Thank you, John. Okay. Well, it was a great conversation because I think a lot of people don't understand Mike Manzer. And, you know, through your reading now, I've become more interested in reading again about him, you know, even though I read about him when I was a teenager. So it was great catching up on him and also talking a little bit about Bruce Lee, too, as well.
Yeah. Hey, I meant to ask you before we sign off, how do you find the Wisdom of Mike Manzer book for you?
I thought it was great. You know, the part I really thought was really interesting, one of the parts I thought was interesting was the posing, about the posing.
Oh, yeah. The yeah. hunger. Yeah.
Yeah. Because we've done shows here on the podcast about how the posing has gone to shit, you know, in bodybuilding.
Don't sugarcoat it.
Yeah.
Come on, handsome.
And about how great some of the other posers used to be, you know.
Yeah.
And he really tied into, you know, what the posing should convey and how it should be heroic and even the type of music that he used and the pose. And I noticed when, you know, he was around, his poses really were great. I mean, you could tell he practiced them a lot, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're distinct. I think a lot of the bodybuilders from that era had distinct poses, like Zane did.
Yeah, you
know?
Yeah.
But as Mike said, too, he said, you know, it would be ridiculous and incongruous for a heavily muscled physique to try
right.
and match the ethereal poses of Frank Zane. He said, it's
yeah.
just, you have to do it to your body type.
Yeah.
So Zane, what he did was obviously perfect for him.
Right.
And what Mike did was awesome for him.
Yeah, well, Mike had a few poses that were his own, you know, like that tricep pose. I see people imitating that today, you know.
Yeah, well, that's cool. That's good. Yeah. Yeah. That one and the hand over the head. And
It was
an interesting era. And Mike is a personality and a figure on the bodybuilding landscape that is sorely missed these days. So
hopefully he'll be forever remembered, because he should be.
Well, I'm glad we're still talking about him. What is it? God. Since 2001, 19 years after his death.
19 years,
amazing.
Right.
You know, we'd have a podcast talking about him. I mean,
yeah.
What other bodybuilder, you know, from that era? I mean, we're not even talking about Steve Reeves on a podcast.
Right, right.
But anyway, I thank you for honoring his memory.
All right. Thank you, John. Thanks for joining me on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Hopefully we can have you on again to talk a little more about Mike Metzger.
I'd be happy to. That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, John. I'll stay in touch.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You. Take care, buddy. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank John Little for spending all that time with us and talking about the memory of Mike Mentzer, and also about Bruce Lee, two great guys who are still legends in the sport of bodybuilding. And, of course, Bruce Lee will be remembered forever. I want to thank our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for continuing to sponsor the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank all our Patreon donors who send us money every month to keep the show going. If you're interested in supporting the show through Patreon, you can do that on the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com website. It's right there in the upper right-hand corner. Just click on that, and you can donate as little as $5 a month if you'd like. I appreciate you guys for even considering that. And next week, we will be joined by bodybuilder Gerard Dente, who was a great bodybuilder in the 1980s. Never got his pro card, but he competed with some of the best in the sport at the time in the 80s and 90s when the sport was really, really tough. And then Gerard went on to create his own supplement company called MHP. So we'll be having that interview next week. All right. Thanks for joining us on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Stay safe out there, guys. Continue working out, and we'll see you next week. Take care.